supposed to speak. We'll deal later today, if there is such a thing as later. There isn't really, but in conventional terms, this afternoon we'll address any questions that may arise. Some may be here already, others may be there. In the meantime, we're here. And it's very still here, which is wonderful. In most places there's always some humming of this or that machine or air conditioner or heating, but here it's still very still. You're already aware of the beautiful spiritual practice of listening to silence when it's there. And in the moment of listening, you will realize that you're not thinking. Now, you may not be able to listen to silence for very long, but in the moment of noticing silence, you're not thinking. That's an amazing thing. And of course, also, since you're not listening to anything, when you listen to silence, silence is nothing, not a form, not a thing. We talked about things last night, but silence is not a thing. It sounds like a thing when we call it silence, because it's a word. But in itself, silence is formless. It is nothingness, one could say. It's no thingness. So you listen to something that is only a space. And in that, you become aware of that which is formless, which is awareness itself. Not in a subject-object relationship, but awareness becoming aware of itself. The field of attention, one could say. Another way of putting it, you are becoming aware of yourself as awareness. I am. The deepest I am-ness underneath the stories that gets mixed up with the stories. So I said in a little book that I wrote recently that's coming out in the summer, it's called Stillness Speaks, that if you lose touch with inner stillness, you lose touch with yourself. And when you lose touch with yourself, you lose yourself in the world. You lose yourself in your mind. You lose yourself in your thoughts, in your emotions, in your perceptions, and in your experiences. Looking for yourself, but not never finding yourself. So that's the world, is all those things. And you lose yourself in that when you lose touch with inner stillness. And then you're looking for yourself, continuously being lost. This is why in India they call that state delusion. You're not really lost, but you think you're lost. It's like a dream. And so the challenge is, it's relatively easy here. There's the helpful silence around you that you can notice. But the challenge is, when you meet the world, which is the world of things, of forms, including your thoughts, we talked about it, including physical things and all those demands that the world makes upon you, when you meet the world, you walk out of here, and the world arises again. Even if we have a period of silence, you walk out of here, and it's more likely that the world, even if you don't speak, in the form of, even if your cell phones are switched off, and there's nobody who can say, you must listen to this, this is what happened. But the cell phone is switched off, but there are other cell phones in the head, and the thought comes, you must think about this. It's the same. So the world arises as your own thoughts in you. So the art of living, one could say, is not to shut out the world and say, I don't want anything to do anymore with the world. I've had enough of it. More than enough. I'm becoming a hermit. I'm going away. I don't want anybody to bother me anymore. They're all mad. The whole world is mad. Leave me alone. But even then, you would still carry the whole mad world with you in your head. And your pain body that you identify with, that becomes thought. And after a few days or weeks of relative peace, perhaps, if that, the world will arise again inside you, even in the hermit. And then the doubts come in, which is the world also. Why am I here? So the art is to deal with things, the things of the world, including your thinking and your emotions and your relationships and your experiences, without the loss of that sense of space or spaciousness. To have the spaciousness while you play with the world. And I'm saying play because it's when you have the spaciousness, you can play with the world. Not in a flippant sense, not in a play, as a beautiful, you're engaged in a dance or play in the world of form. Not play in the sense of I'm superior to it or whatever, no, control or anything like that. No, you participate in the play. But you can only do that when there is not a complete loss of awareness of space or awareness of awareness, which is the same. Space. So the question at any moment in your life is, where is the space at this moment? Am I totally getting drawn into object consciousness, into things, into reactions, into thoughts, into emotions? So that a vital question at any moment is whether you have lost the space and you have lost yourself in things, in the world. And that's very easy to happen. You all know that, how easy it is, because the world seems to have such an enormous gravitational pull, the things of the world, including the inner world. And so, there are quite a few people who can be very spiritual, which means still inside and present and aware, can be very spiritual when they're not being disturbed. When they're left alone, they're sitting alone in their room. Or out in nature, it's beautiful too, it's very helpful. And that's good that you have at least there you can be still. And even the majority of the population don't have that. They can't, even when they're alone in their room, they're tormented continuously by their minds. So they're never, at least you have that, but then at some point you have to come out of your room. Or you have to leave nature and go back into the human world. And there we go again. And then how quickly do you lose all sense of space or spaciousness? How quickly do the things of this world pile up? And then your inner space is crammed full with things. No sense of space left. So many things to think about and deal with and to react to. So this, the art then is, one could almost say, to live in two dimensions simultaneously. As long as you are here as a form, a physical form, you are also in the world of form. You cannot prematurely leave that. And there's a reason why you're here. It's actually through facing the dilemma of finding yourself disguised as a form, consciousness disguised as a form, and then forgetting who you are, through that dilemma that you encounter of being here in the world of form, it's only through the dilemma that you go deeper. So you don't find the dimension of the formless through removing yourself from the world of form, but through the form itself becomes an opening when you are in a right relationship to the forms. So that's the art that everyone here is here to master. One could say your purpose is to be a bridge between two worlds, the formless world of consciousness and consciousness manifested as form, a bridge between that, and that's the dance. And when, if you lose the dimension of stillness, formless, the world becomes a place of misery and suffering sooner or later, with brief episodes of delusional happiness. I often cite as a typical example of delusional brief happiness the honeymoon experience. But that's only a metaphor for there are many different kinds of honeymoons when some form comes into your life and seems to suddenly fulfill you for a moment. So that's at any moment then in your life, especially in relationships, but one could say you're always in relationship with something or someone. Even one could say you have a relationship also with your mind, with your thinking and with your emotions. So the question is, is spaciousness being obscured at this moment by things? Or is there still a sense of spaciousness while you deal with things, while you speak, while you answer the phone, talk to people, see what needs to be done, give attention to this person, to that person, or to this matter that needs dealing with, or driving, or waiting for this or that. And even while your mind produces thoughts, are you completely lost in the thoughts, or is there still in the background a certain stillness, a certain sense of space? And that is there when you're aware of the kind of thoughts that go through your head and you're not totally absorbed by each thought, then there is space. You no longer totally believe in each thought. That means there is space beyond the thought in you. It's those people who totally believe in each thought that comes into their head. They are lost in the world, lost in thought. And then you act on that, on a partial and extremely relative truth, that this thought expresses a tiny perspective, and then you take action. And you can, what that leads to, you don't see that this thought is only a relative truth. The action arises out of a relative viewpoint, and of course it brings more suffering. It's not the totality acting through you, because sometimes action is required. But true action doesn't come out of this mental decision-making. It comes out of becoming still, finding the space, being the space. And then action comes, or the right word comes out of that, unpremeditated. Another way, because it's good to give you a choice of pointers, a choice to apply in your life, another way of asking yourself that question, whether there is still space in you, in any situation, at any moment, you could ask, where is the now? Because the now is space, the space in which things happen. Now is not what happens, it is the space in which whatever happens, happens. So the now is just another perspective on it. So if you become aware of the field of now, that's called present moment awareness, one could say, aware of awareness again, the field of now, then that's the space. There's the space. And there's then what happens. Then what happens becomes, you can, when you have mastered the art of living in the two dimensions, then you realize the primordial dimension is the dimension of space, of being, because that is the source. Or whatever happens comes out of that and goes back into that. And so whatever then happens on the level of events and happenings is always of secondary importance. That is called liberation from the world. Free. That is what Jesus referred to when he said, I have overcome the world. Who was he to say, I have overcome the world? He didn't have worldly power, armies to command, bank accounts, nothing, and said, I have overcome the world. So he was talking, of course, about this, to realize then that whatever happens on that level of form is secondary in importance. It is relatively important, perhaps, healthy, sick, rich, poor, gain, loss, relatively important, happy, unhappy, just got something, just lost something, relatively important, but none of that is absolutely important. When the relative masquerades as absolute, then life gets heavy and serious. And so it's only when you recognize the relative as relative, then really, one could say it is the end of suffering. Because in the truest meaning of the word, suffering is mistaking the relative for the absolute. It doesn't mean that you cannot experience physical pain anymore, or certain things may happen on the level of form, which are part of the level of form. On the level of forms, occasionally things collapse. Occasionally things dissolve. It is in the nature of form that occasionally it crumbles. All forms, whether it be situations or material structures or relationships, whatever on the level of form, or some philosophy you arranged in your mind that explains it all, as they do, people who believe in dogmas do, and So you've rearranged, and at some point, something will happen and even that will crumble. Many people, you may remember or may have read, when the communist regime in East Germany collapsed and the collective belief in dogma collapsed, and that was a country where every fifth person was a government informer. They had buildings full of piles and piles of information on people. Later, that was open to public access, and people were amazed. They had information about everybody. What for? Mad. You can't explore madness any further. You can only say it's mad. And many people, there were a very high rate of suicides when it collapsed, because they have the philosophies that they had arranged, the way in which the universe, the world, they explained it to themselves, didn't make sense anymore. And because they were lost in the relative, they all what was left was to kill themselves. Life didn't make sense anymore. Completely lost in mind, in the relative. They say in Japan sometimes, maybe less so now, when people lost their jobs, because a job was a lifelong identification with your company, they would often commit suicide. Again, being lost in the relative. When the stock market crashed in the 30s, maybe it still happens now, the famous visual image that we still have is people jumping off skyscrapers because their life was empty now. Their stocks reduced to nothing. What's left? Nothing. Nothing left. Nothing left. So there... there's the beautiful balance. So ask yourself then, where's the space, or where's the now, whatever pointer? And that can awaken that little pointer. That pointer is not it, but that pointer points to the... it can awaken you. Even if you have to have a little external sign for a little while, don't get attached to it. On your door as you go out, or come on your office door, desk, where's the now, or something like that. But don't use it for too long. It's always good after a while to discard pointers, because they can become little deities, little... And the moment people start building the church of now, you know that they've lost the now. So there's the walking, and this is really the purpose of being, is to learn that. And then the beautiful liberation is that whatever happens in your life is secondary. Relatively important, perhaps, but never absolutely important. And that includes what doesn't happen either. It includes not winning the lottery, or winning the lottery, or making it in the eyes of the world, which is a meaningless thing anyway, but it's how people think. Making it in the eyes of the world, or not making it in the eyes of the world. Just little stories that people tell. When you finally make it, you realize it's not a big thing. Making it is quite meaningless. It's a fiction, too. So, whatever happens or doesn't happen may be important, but not absolutely so. To know that, not as an intellectual belief, But to know that within yourself, within the very cell structure of your body, to know that. To dwell in space consciousness, to be that. To derive your identity from that, which is so different from the egoic identity that the Buddha called it no-self, so that you don't confuse it with something that is not like that at all. That deepest I, or I am, that has nothing to do with form and nothing to do with time, is confused with identification with I am Mr. So-and-so, I am the accountant, the managing director, the street sweeper, I am the mother, the father, I am the one who made it, the one who failed, the one who made it, whatever. All these form identifications, the greatest illusion lies in the most frequently used word in the language, I. That word contains the greatest illusion and potentially the deepest truth. Usually, when it's used, it refers to the greatest illusion of I. And that's what the Buddha referred to when he talked of the illusion of self. A fiction in the mind, a story. Identification with forms, with things, with thoughts, with emotions, a bundle of thoughts. That's me, my past, my future. So the most frequently used word in the language, I, is the core delusion. But that potentially, that word, I, also speaks of the deepest truth of who you are when there is, that is the I prior to identification with forms. I am, not this or that. The deeper sense of beingness or presence that is the space, that is the inner stillness. And to have that even as you speak, to let that in the background, so to speak, it's there. As you answer the phone, saying, this check didn't clear, you wrote a check, and something must have happened, the bank, I got it returned, now what am I going to do, I have to pay my credit. Oh, okay. Well, let's see what we can do. Always have a little, bring in, it helps to, little gaps. Let's see what we can do. We could do this. I could call the bank manager. Or maybe I could write you another check. So action arises, but there's space around it. Thoughts arise, but there's space around the thoughts. Not. But the world, especially in the form of the human mind, has this pull. It provokes you, it wants you to interact with it on its own vibrational frequency. It doesn't want you to interact, but it doesn't want the space. It wants you to be equally nervous and agitated. So the person who is speaking to you, because that person is lost in the world, is lost in the mind, so there isn't really anybody there. There's just the frequency of the human mind. And the frequency of the human mind wants you to, what's the word? Interact on it on its own level. It wants you to even feed it, to contribute to that frequency. So it wants you to be nervous also, to be agitated and upset. Now, the person who is talking to you doesn't know that because it's all unconscious. There's nobody really there. There's only the mind stream there. And the mind stream says, come on, give me more of this. This is so important. Surely you must agree that we should all be very anxious about this. It's not saying that, but it's implied. So then it loves when you can you can react on the same level, then it increases. It gets even stronger. And then if you can draw in other people, that's even better. Make another phone call. You know what happened? Oh, no. And then you can get on the emails. And if you happen to be powerful, if you have worldly power, you could go to such an extreme as that you pick up the phone and says, send in the army. And they don't realize there's no space left whatsoever. There's just that. And that is the same, this art, the two dimensions, living in the two dimensions. It applies also when many of you work with people. Some of you are doctors, nurses, body workers, social workers, quite some of you are teachers. You work with people, and there's a form in which you work with people. There's a modality of working, whatever is the pre-existing modality of what you do. And so the question is, does the modality or the structure tend to obscure space consciousness? Does it tend to obscure presence, or is it a vehicle for presence? Can presence and that sense of spaciousness flow into the modality, or is there a tendency for the modality to obscure space, for the modality to be totally mind-dominated? And if it is, then the question arises, is there any way that this modality that I use and when I work with people, is there any way that this modality can make room? Is there room in it for space? So, for example, if you are a body worker, then there is great room for space because mental concepts don't come in very much. And words don't come in very much. So easily that sense of spaciousness, of stillness, can flow into your movements, the touch, and so on. Works beautifully. However, if you are a doctor, there are certain requirements on the level of form that have to be met. Doctors need to take notes. They listen and they take notes. And here we have, that is the world of form and of thought. So, is it possible for you not to become totally drawn into that? Not saying you can't take, you have to take notes, yes. Is it possible to take notes with space? Is it possible to, while you are not scribbling something, to listen to that person in spaciousness, spacious, still awareness? Then step from the stillness back into thought and write something down. Then step out of thought again and look at the past. So you step in and out of thought. And after a while you notice, even while there is thought, there is still a spaciousness in the background or around it. So words are always limited. So you can see, I know some doctors are already mastering that. Some still have difficulty with it, of getting drawn into that, and perhaps this afternoon some of you may want to say something about it, how it is for you. You may be a psychoanalyst, probably not, but the typical picture that we have of psychoanalysts is they sit a little bit behind you, the patient lies on the couch, they still do it, and there's something good there too, but they still do it, but they're writing continuously, whatever the person, the content of the mind that comes up, they write it all down. And so they have glasses and... Well, and then what happened? They speak. The content of your mind, repressed content, comes up. And the psychoanalyst fills volumes and volumes of scribbles with. And then it can happen after 10 or 15 or 20 years of scribbling as the psychoanalyst. The psychoanalyst finds that for longer periods he's not scribbling, he's just listening. And he scribbles a little less. And may not know quite what's happening. And it can happen that in people who work with people, the spaciousness arises without them even ever having heard about it. It arises naturally. It happens to some. So after a while, they become much more effective in what they do because they have gone beyond the form, beyond the mind structures that are associated with whatever they do, and something that is deeper than mind comes in, even though they may, to some extent, still be using certain structures. That's beautiful when that happens. But you don't have to wait for 20 or 30 years for it to happen naturally, which perhaps it would, but to see whether it is possible to bring presence into this very the structures that you have to use. And if you're a teacher, there are certain structures there that are, of course, created by the mind. And they're not created by the mind that is in touch with spaciousness. Most of the structures of the world, if you go into companies and institutions, government institutions, corporations. In most cases, there are a few enlightened companies, but in most cases, the structure is entirely the product of thought, of mind. It doesn't allow for space at all. So that is why when you go into certain corporations, many, it doesn't feel so good. Everybody's fighting against everybody else. And then their little power groups here, they, us against them, and even within the little groups, it's a nightmare world. And yet, even there, the question is it possible to bring space? And of course, in most cases, it is. Schools, many schools are very agitated and nervous places. There are some alternative schools that may be different. And again, is it possible for you to use? Of course, then the demands being made upon you as a teacher, that they have to learn this, they have to pass an exam. You have to evaluate and judge them, each one. And perhaps what really matters, the system, the structure, has no place to evaluate whether a student has an inner stillness or not. You can, when you write the reports, the end-of-term reports, there's no section that speaks of inner stillness at all. So, again, in many cases, the world can actually probably change from within those structures if more people bring in spaciousness or presence. And it is a challenge, especially heavy mind-dominated structures can be a big challenge. But it can be done. And if it cannot be done, you will find yourself being removed from where you are. That's beautiful too. You will find yourself, either you suddenly, one morning you get a letter, it says, we do not require your services anymore. Or you yourself write the letter. So bringing in into whatever you do, bringing the space as the most essential factor in what you do, not the external structure. That needs to be honored also. But it is not the most essential factor. It's never the most essential factor. So there's always, and the space is greater than you. It is, in essence, it is you, but it is greater than the little, far greater than what the little me could do. All healing arises from that. All true transformation arises out of that. And it's very rare for human beings, for people who work with others, to have no structure whatsoever. So that's possible. It's beautiful when it happens. This is how typically in India spiritual teaching happens in many cases, that there is an almost complete absence of firm structure. In other words, the teacher doesn't, well, they have, some teachers have techniques, but the true teachers, they just sit there. And you come to them, and if you're lucky, they are there. If you're not lucky, they have gone. They've gone somewhere. Nobody knows when they're coming back. And they just sit. And there's not, all that there is presence, beingness, spaciousness. And that's the most powerful thing. It transmits itself. And there may come a time for you too. There may come a time, there doesn't have to be, when all structures fall away. The ways in which you interact with people. And then people ask you, can I come and see you for a session? And you say, okay. And they ask, well, what do you do in a session? I don't know. Just come and see. I don't know what I do. I don't do anything. And it's not just a clever answer. You truly don't know what you do because you don't do anything as such. Just that. Or you continue to use whatever form it is and presence flows into it beautifully. It becomes a vehicle for that spaciousness. In other words, this stillness becomes an essential part of even the form. A typical example of that would be the simple thing of a simple movement that you make. Picking up a flower, putting it in a vase, without any interference of thought, just that. And without saying, okay, now this flower has to go to that particular place there, it goes where it needs to go by itself. It knows where it fits in relation to the totality. So that, and there's an intelligence then that comes into play that is far greater than, and that can, so this is just a little example how presence, spaciousness, whatever you aware, flows into, can flow into the doing, into a movement. as every artist knows, but is not confined to art. It can flow into every step that you walk. Drinking. A certain quality then comes into what you do that is absent when there is no spaciousness in the doing. If there is spaciousness as you do, and the quality, it's hard to explain what I mean by quality, but I believe that you know, you can sense what is meant by that word, quality, that flows into what you do out of spaciousness. There is presence in the doing, which means the future is not more important than this moment. When the mind is there and spaciousness is lost, the next moment is always more important than this one. That's always how the mind, because it needs to get to the end of it already, because then there's the next thing to do. And that means when people come to you, you don't want the next moment, which is, I want them to get better. I want them to awaken. I want them to be happy again. That is also an obstacle and a hindrance, because that prevents you from being fully there in presence, in spacious presence with them. Because you, yes, you have good intentions, but those good intentions prevent the deeper intelligence that dwells in the presence, that is the presence, that is the primordial intelligence, from coming into that situation and resolving it from within, rather than somebody coming in from the outside and say, I'm going to rearrange that situation to make you better. It's a very natural thing to feel that you want to help someone, but if it becomes a wanting something that is not here now, wanting something to be different instead of a deep acceptance of what is, that's where the deepest, the true healing comes in through that. Because the mind will tell you, I can't accept that this person is so miserable. I can't accept that this person is suffering so much. No, it's, of course, on the human level, you can't, perhaps. You go beyond that, and it is the deepest surrender to this moment as it is. And that's where a power comes in that you could never, the mind is totally beyond what the mind could ever devise, systems or techniques for this or that. It comes from within. And so that you are the provider of that space. It comes through you, and you are not separate from the space. We have to use language, unfortunately. So not even not wanting this moment to be different from the way it is, and then the deepest and true change happens. It's almost a paradox. In the deepest acceptance, it happens. Because if you don't, then you are saying in some way that the universe is perverse. It doesn't, it shouldn't have done that to you. But it is, as it is, always. And the totality of the universe has brought it about. The totality, and we cannot understand through the mind why an event that seems senseless, that has happened to somebody, to make a person suffer, say, why does that happen to me? Or why does it happen to this person? It doesn't make sense. This person had a whole life ahead of them, and now they've fallen ill and they might die prematurely, or so the mind says. This shouldn't be happening. This is, or even the worst is a child falling ill. It's the most difficult to accept. If it's a child dies, it seems this is against the entire law of the universe, that life should be taken away from somebody who has hardly started to live. So it seems so natural that when you meet, let's say, a child who is very sick comes to you, that you feel this shouldn't be happening and you really want that child to get better. But nobody, the human mind cannot understand why certain things happen within the totality, but it can understand, especially now since the arrival of modern physics, the human mind can understand that there are no isolated events. Everything is connected with everything else. It's only through our superficial sense perceptions that we isolate something and say this is an event. But an event is part of the totality of the cosmos. It is probably connected even to things in other galaxies. It's so one. The entire universe is one organism, one being. And everything there is interconnected. So there are no separate or isolated events, but we cannot possibly understand through the human mind what function a seemingly senseless event has within the totality. And that includes the worst things that humans have done to other humans, created hell on the planet, the worst things, concentration camps, world wars, people building chemical and other devilish things that even in your wildest dreams you couldn't even think of. And they make them to inflict suffering on other humans. It all seems, and then, yeah, why? And even that within the totality has a function. But we cannot understand, because all we see is a fragment. If you had a huge painting and you took a tiny fragment out of it, just a little pigment, you would say, what's that? Doesn't make sense. What is this? It's only if you could see the totality, you can see that's where it fits in. Sometimes one can get a glimpse of that, just a glimpse of it, when you see a seemingly negative event, a seemingly something that shouldn't be happening. At this time you have this crisis, Iraq and so on. In the 60s you had Vietnam. Let's look at that just for a moment to get a glimpse. Here on the one hand you have this war, which was later recognized even by the people in power as probably a mistake, as Robert McNamara, the then defense secretary, wrote in his autobiography, probably a mistake. Unfortunately, 50,000 young Americans died in it and many more Vietnamese. Probably a mistake, great suffering inflicted, yes. But at the same time, there was an enormous awakening on the planet, especially coming from America and the West Coast, a spiritual awakening, a great movement of spiritual awakening. And somehow that seemingly negative event cannot completely be separated from the awakening, because the awakening was seeing the madness of the collective human mind. The seeing of the madness of the collective human mind was actually part of the awakening of many thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of people disidentifying from collective forms that they until then had become completely identified with. the collective structures, stepping out of that. And so the seemingly negative and the awakening, and I'm not explaining it away, just saying there's a, you can get a little glimpse of to see how sometimes that fits. And for humans to see what they have done in the 20th century, what the humanity has done out of the madness, which is the madness of being lost in things, in the world of mind, in the world of form, totally identified with forms, the egoic, collective egoic mind. And then what it does. This moment is as it is because it cannot be otherwise. That's all we know. And the more deeply we know this, the more even the world of form, of things, changes. And this is, we now come to something we've been speaking about, living in the two dimensions. But when humans, or when a human being lives in the two dimensions, the form, the world of things, and the formless stillness, spaciousness, that stillness does something also to the way in which you experience the world of form. It something flows into the world of form that does not remove certain polarities that are always inherent in the world of form, and yet makes the world of form a more benign, softer place. With polarities still there, yes, forms do still dissolve and crumble here and there, but without the harshness and the incredible suffering that is there when the deeper dimension is absent in a human's life. So that's where the world becomes a more benevolent place, which it already is. It's the human mind that creates hell. The planet itself is a beautiful jewel of unspeakable beauty. And humans are poisoning it and destroying it, and madness, it is what is. You see it. The more humans see the madness of it, the more change comes. And that's happening. Wow, it's mad. It's mad. Mad. And you can't fight madness. You become mad yourself. And this is an interesting truth. If you fight madness, you become mad. You get drawn into the madness. If you fight unconsciousness, you will be drawn into unconsciousness. So just to see it is enough. You can point it out, yes. You can write to newspapers about it without the fighting spirit behind it, because then you personalize unconsciousness. You make an identity out of it, and you call certain people or groups bad. They may be bad because they're doing dreadful things to the planet, but that's not their identity. They embody human unconsciousness. So here also, surrender and acceptance of what is, to see the madness, is a very powerful thing. Wow. So the beauty is, as you bring space consciousness into the world of form, the world of form becomes a more benign place. You encounter more love, because what we call love, what we call joy, or what we call compassion, only flows out of the space, not out of the movement of thought. Love is not produced by the movement of thought and not by the movement of emotion either, because the emotional love is, I want you and then I hate you and I want you. It's deeper even than emotion. And so love, joy, compassion come out of space. They are inseparable from that inner spaciousness. And so then, yes, a world is possible, not a world that is totally free of polarities, because there would be no world anymore. The entire universe would implode, and all that would be left would be the One, God, the unmanifested One left. All polarities are gone. No high and low anymore, no good and bad anymore. But as long as the world is there, the polarities are there, and that also is accepted. When you accept the polarities, they are actually quite beautiful too. You accept loss when loss comes. You accept gain when gain comes. You accept the bad weather when the bad weather comes. And then the bad weather isn't bad weather anymore. It's only called bad weather because so many humans didn't accept it. So they called it bad. When it rains, they called it bad weather. But there's nothing bad about rain. In fact, if last night you listen to it, you can see how beautiful it is. Well, the mind say, okay, it was beautiful because I was in bed. But it wouldn't have been beautiful if I'd been stuck outside and getting drenched. Well, you have to try it. Just be outside and get drenched and don't call it bad. A friend of mine did that years ago. I wasn't a teacher then. I was still just talking to people at university. We hadn't been talking about the weather, but one day he came one morning and said, you know what we were talking about yesterday, acceptance and so on. He said, this morning I was on my bike, got totally drenched in the rain, and he said, and you know what? I became a duck, and it was great. He felt he was a duck. Now, that may not have been a totally accurate image, because ducks don't actually get wet, but it doesn't matter. It worked for him, because for him, being a duck meant not resisting, feeling wet, just feel wet. Nobody calling it good or bad. It is as it is at this moment. You don't change it by calling it bad. And you do what you have to do. You might seek shelter, or you might go home and take off your wet clothes. And there's a beauty in all that. There's a beauty in many, many things that the mind would have called bad in its habitual state of resistance. There are so many things that are habitually called bad. If you drop something, it breaks, you call it, oh. And that's an habitual movement. And then an amazing thing happens when these things, and you become so present that you drop something and you just look. And there is a beauty even in that broken cup. There's a beauty in that when the mind doesn't call it anything, because that's where the world of form goes. All forms eventually, one way or another, have to go that way. So why say this shouldn't have happened? At least not yet. I wanted to enjoy this cup another 20 years. Who knows? Your body may be gone in a year. So the polarities are there, but then they've become actually quite pleasant polarities. they're actually to be enjoyed. You don't hang on to one polarity. So this is what I want and that's what I don't want. So this is perhaps the arising of getting lost in thought, getting lost in mind. That was what in the Bible is described, of course, as eating of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. Like, dislike, good, bad. And then this became the state of humanity. At first it was a great thing. They could do things that animals couldn't do. And then thousands and thousands and thousands of years passed, and then they got taken over by that thing in the head and lost space, beingness, source. And then it's the destiny of humans to find it again, and then find it at a deeper level than what they when they lost it. It always happens when you find something, there's a deeper dimension than when you've had it, you didn't even know you had it. Then perhaps this is what in the Old Testament, in the book of Genesis, is hinted at when we read of there's not only in this garden, there's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There's another tree that is mentioned briefly, and that's the tree of life. And so, I don't think God ever said they mustn't eat of the tree of life, but that's what it says there. There is the tree of life also available for humans, and so perhaps the next step is to eat of the tree of life. And perhaps this event is part of that.